Our topic tonight is the chakras, which is a huge, gigantic topic. And I'm only going to be able to, I'm going to tell you a lot, but I'm not going to be able to tell you everything. We've passed out this little flyer. It just alerts you to the fact that I have a YouTube channel. And on that channel, you'll find a four-part series about the chakras. It's not too hard to navigate the site. And a whole lot of people have watched that, and I get reports that it's really quite good. So you'll learn parts of what I do that, but that class being 8 hours of classes gave me a lot more chance than I'll have tonight. So if you like what you're hearing, you can go onto that YouTube channel and look. And then there's about 700 other videos on all sorts of subjects. So I'll give you first a little bit of context about myself, since only some of you have ever been here before when I've been here. And I'm not presenting my own ideas, although these are ideas that I've become quite persuaded are true. When I was 22 years old, I met a direct disciple of they don't have the hook on this thing, so I have to carry it. This man, this book, Autobiography of a Yogi, which is one of the classics of spiritual literature for all time. It was published in 1948, and it's still a bestseller on best-selling lists. And if you haven't read it, I really encourage you to. It's sort of like the foundation text for much of what's going on in the West spiritually and also in India. Yogananda, his name, that's his picture there, was born in India, but his mission was in America. He was really the first Indian teacher to come and live in the West. And he settled in Los Angeles and lived there until 1952 when he died. In 1948, a man named Donald Walters, who later became known as Swami Kriyananda, an American man, read Autobiography of a Yogi. It was actually published in 1946. It had been out 2 years. Kriyananda read it, Donald Walters. At that time, he was in New York City. Yogananda was in Los Angeles. He read the book. He was a young man, had just dropped out of college, didn't know what to do. The book just completely took him. He crossed the country, became a disciple of Yogananda. So for the last almost 4 years of Yogananda's life, Kriyananda, which is who he became, lived with him, and then went on to do his own spiritual work. Kriyananda died just over 2 years ago, 3 years ago. He died in 2013 in April, in his late 80s. And I was 22, as it happened, in 1969 when I met Swami Kriyananda. And I immediately became, absolutely persuaded that this man had what I wanted and that I wanted to learn what he had. And I really never looked back. Kriyananda was starting at that time a community up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, which is still going strong, and it's called Ananda. Ananda means joy. And it was just starting then. Now it's a highly developed place, but then it was just very, very primitive, and it was fantastic. And I went up there and joined that community, lived in the mountains for 16 years, and then came back to this area in 1986, which is where I've been living ever since. Starting another community and a temple and a school for children. And East West Bookshop is actually run under the auspices of Ananda, although it's its own separate entity. What is that noise? Is that because this thing moves? Oh, well, we'll just have to live with it. And that's all I've done. I've done nothing but, I've always worked within the context of Ananda not in an administrative or a bureaucratic way, because Ananda wasn't really there. I helped create it and helped create what really goes on here in Palo Alto, especially Mountain View, Palo Alto. So the teachings that I'm talking about, as I was starting to say, I didn't invent them. It wasn't like I had this perception of reality that no one had ever had before. But I've studied Yogananda's teachings for a long, long time and practiced meditation and contemplated these teachings and was personally trained by Kriyananda. So the reason I say that is not everybody teaches these subjects just the same. And I don't defend entirely just from my own point of view, but because it comes from a very orthodox and a very deep line of teaching. If it disagrees with things that you've been told, I'll give you a chance to raise your hand and ask me the questions, and I'll do my best, if possible, to reconcile. Because usually when there appear to be disagreements about objective truth, because the chakras, although subtle, are an objective reality, and objective truth is simply what it is. But sometimes when you look at it from different sides, it looks different. Okay? So, I'll use the chalkboard a lot tonight. Where can I stand that I'm not blocking? This is probably better. What we're working with, and I'll just start with the word on the board, is chakra. The word chakra actually means a wheel. And the reason, I may not even start here, but anyway, the word chakra means wheel. And the reason it's called wheel is because we're dealing with moving energy that moves in a circular pattern, and that's where the word chakra comes from. It's a Sanskrit word, and there's no equivalence in English, because people in English who spoke English weren't interested in these subjects, so we didn't make up words for them. But English just takes in the words from other countries when we get interested, so chakras become practically an English word. What we're working with when we're working with the chakras is we're working with the subtler reality of who we are and why we are the way we are. Most of us, when we define ourselves, we look in the mirror, we see the face, we see the physical body, we fix our hair, we change our clothes. But if you ask, who am I, this is generally what the definition is, the name, the relationships, and so on. We have an interesting continuing sense of ourself through all kinds of different experiences, including, starting with childhood. On my way walking over here, I was just walking from the parking lot, and there was a little child who probably, I'm not sure how old children are when they start to walk, but this child was just over that. But youth is no obstacle to personality, and this child was quite entirely and totally convinced of herself and her own being. And she was just walking sternly along, and I just looked at her, and I don't think she talks much. She just sort of said something that was obviously the equivalent of a hello, which totally amused her parents. But there was such an intensely obvious person present. There was no question. This wasn't just like a part of a person. The whole person was there. It was just that she was little and she couldn't speak yet, and she couldn't drive a car or anything like that. But she was entirely there. And all of us have vague or constant or large or small memories of our own, who we were as children. But if we're just thinking about our physical body, think how very different our bodies were there, our capacities. And nonetheless, we remember it as recognizably ourselves, don't we? We even look at little pictures and we can tell, that was me, I know it was me. And as we age, and so many changes take place in our bodies, and we become old, and as we become elderly, which I'm right on the cusp of that, everything again about you changes. You lose your capacity to do all sorts of things. You look different. You have to live differently. But still there's that continuing inner reality, isn't there? There was a little girl, this is a Reader's Digest joke, a little girl, was taken to visit her grandmother in an elder home. And there's one very old lady there, and she said, how old are you? The little girl said, how old are you? The lady said, 97. The little girl said, did you begin at one? Because it just seemed so different to her, doesn't it? But when you're inside of it, I speak from experience now, when you're inside of it, you're always yourself somehow. And even though you can go through not only physical but enormous different changes, there's just always yourself quality to it. And now people have all these near-death experiences where you go out of your body entirely and you have these completely other realities, but still you're always yourself in there, aren't you? And so when we're starting to talk about the chakras, what we're actually talking about is that enduring self. Because if we take ourselves only physically, or even take ourselves even only mentally, we can see how many different changes we go through, but somehow behind all of that oscillating reality, there's something enduring and identifiable that is always me. And so we can't be talking about the physical or the mental self. We have to be talking about something that's untouched by that. So the system of the chakras is an explanation. It's not only, it's the anatomy of the non-physical reality. And then it becomes, where it becomes extremely interesting is when we discuss how that non-physical reality actually determines the world that we live in an external way as well. And it's real interesting. We'll just get there in a minute. If we even look at ourselves physiologically, we recognize that a great deal of what we are physically emanates from the spine. The whole science of being a chiropractic or osteopathy is all based on this just physiological awareness that all these nerve centers are in the spine and that everything comes out from there. When I was first introduced to the concept of chiropractic manipulation many, many years ago, I had, and I still occasionally get, I get a headache right here. And, you know, I think if I didn't know about chiropractic, they might have taken a piece of my brain out by now. But it doesn't really come from here. It comes from here. And from here often comes from the middle of my back here. And it starts pushing that whole thing out. And then there's pressure on the nerves, but it hurts right here. Interestingly, right now, one of my toes tingles at certain times, but it emanates from something that happens to my hip, and what happens to my hip happens from my spine. But it all traces back to the center point, and it's like a miracle sometimes, you know, that they'll adjust my hip and my toe won't feel the same, or they'll adjust my back and my head stops hurting. Just because there's an origin point that emanates out like that. Now, the principle of spiritual life is that the enduring reality of us, as I was starting to say a few minutes ago, is a non-physical self that inhabits a physical body for a time, and beginning from conception, actually, but through birth and then through the last breath, that which we call ourself inhabits and animates this physical, but is actually unaffected by it in a certain sense. You know, the spiritual affects the physical, but the physical doesn't affect the spiritual. Well, that sounds different than I mean it to sound, but I'll make it more clear in a moment. Again, we're very much helped these days by all these death and return experiences, which have become so common and are so fascinating. Common, perhaps, is not the right word, but they're much more widely known. I can refer to it and everybody knows what I'm talking about now. That a person's body will die and then they will tell us, but they simply get up from it. And the movies do it just perfectly. You know, the actor falls over and then the same actor gets up. The body stays there, but the actor moves around now, but he's not bound by the same laws, because what's moving around now is a vibrational energy form that resembles, and in the case of the movies, looks exactly like the other body because it's the same actor, but has different laws. It can hear and see and feel and move through walls and not be perceived by physical beings because we're not vibrating anymore on the wavelength where the physical body can be seen. One of my favorite comments from the death and return experience was, it was from Daniel Brinkley, and when he died, he was struck by lightning and died, and the paramedics came, and he looked over at his body. He said, "I always thought I was better looking than that." That was his response. I'm sure having just been struck by lightning, his body wasn't in prime condition, but nonetheless, I thought I was better looking. But you have this sort of funny relationship suddenly with your body where you feel it to be like a suit of clothes. I mean, the analogy of the way we change clothes exactly describes how we change bodies. Now, of course, we're moving into the realm of reincarnation because the chakras are just intimately connected, integral, to the concept of reincarnation and karma and the chakras. It's the three systems. Oops, ladies are in the wrong place. Huh? The three elements are completely connected to each other, and one explains each other, and that's what we're going to talk about. Louisa was asking particularly about karma. Let me just get back where I was. Oh yes, the analogy that the near death experiences, the death and return experiences. I prefer to call them death and return because the people actually do die. They're not near death; they're just impermanent death, temporary death, whatever you want to call it. Is telling us is how we do. They're demonstrating so clearly how we put the body on and off, and all of us, you know, walk around in whatever we walk around in. I've taken a certain initiation, so I always wear this blue color, and I almost always wear something that looks almost exactly like this. So my clothes have become almost like my body because they don't change very much. Prior to that, I was more lively in my choices, and we just changed clothes all the time, but you always knew who you were inside of it, didn't you? And even though it could influence you, the way you felt, you always knew who you were inside of it, because there was a continuing reality. Even if you put on a costume so complete that other people couldn't recognize you, you still knew who you were inside. Now, here's a funny bit of individuality. A friend of mine works in the deaf community, and she works with sign language. And she says at Halloween, even when everybody's all dressed up in costumes, maybe their faces don't even show, as soon as they begin to sign, the personality of signing is as individual as the human voice. Isn't that interesting? You can't masquerade. Just like someone will recognize your voice, they'll recognize the style in which you sign. I thought that was just fascinating, because it is, it's the voice, it's the way of expressing. Yeah. So now, coming back to here. So what the anatomy of that energetic body is, it tells us that the physical body is an expression of a more subtle body that actually resembles, not quite as completely as the actors do, but it still very strongly resembles what we see physiologically. And primarily what it resembles is this, the center, the spine, being the origin point, and the nerves and the activating key also running through the center of ourselves. So just as, you know, this body comes from the center out like this, so the chakras run through the center of the spine. Now, let me say that more clearly, because the chakras are not physical. They are a vibration of energy that actually is like, it runs from the top of the head to the base of the spine, but like a plumb line right through the center, and the physical body is built around it. And the reason the physical body is built around it is because those chakras are holding the karma of each of us as an individual. And I said earlier, a chakra is a wheel, meaning it's a moving energy field. If energy is moving, it creates magnetism. So literally, the chakras are vibrating, and they draw to a focus the atoms and the molecules with which we make a physical body. And when the physical body's day is done, when a person dies, what leaves is that whole energy body steps out. And it continues. It continues in the astral world, the energy world, but that's a different vibration than this one. And as soon as that energy self removes itself from this physical self, the physical self has no way to sustain itself. It can't. It's the moving energy in the chakras that attract and renew and give it the capacity. I recently spent 6 weeks in Portland with a woman friend of mine who died. She had pancreatic cancer, but she was relatively young, being my age. And her body was very strong, even though the cancer was there. So she endured longer than anyone thought she would, just because the body itself was strong despite the cancer. But it was really an amazing experience to just watch the self recede further and further back into just to this vibration of energy. But nonetheless, she was still there until she wasn't. But then the moment she wasn't, it just ends completely. I don't know how many of you have actually sat with someone when they breathe their last, With her, I was in the hospice process much longer than I had ever been before, but I had been with a number of other people. It's just, it's an amazing experience because they're present and then they're not. And then when the body is left, once the energy has energy self is removed, the body is so not the person. It's just so stunningly not the person. One of my friends said, having only known, she spoke of her father, having only known my father through that body, I made the natural mistake of thinking he was that body. But as soon as she described it, she was away from the hospital room when he died. And so she came back, and she came back a half an hour or so after he left. She said she was aware of two things simultaneously. The first was having only known him through the body. That's who I thought he was. But there was his body, and it was so clear to her that he was not that body. But it was also clear to her that he was still in the room. He was completely present, but he just wasn't in the body anymore. Because the energy self is your true self. So the way that this was the last thing I wanted to say about the chakras running from the crown to the base of the spine in a plumb line down. Now, they don't exist on the same plane as the physical. So it's not like they need physical space. So none of this needs physical space. So it's interesting if you think about it, because a person can exist without arms and without legs all the way up to this point. But a person can't exist if the body is cut or taken apart. Any space within, from the crown of the head to the base of the spine, then they can't live anymore. You never see someone who is only here to the waist, but you do see people who are terribly deformed or have been blown apart in war or something. But you can still just be this much, because that is what's required. The chakras, each chakra has a responsibility, and there's no way that you can go less than that. And so the chakras actually exist, if we were going to think of it physically, and this is my fabulous drawing of a human being here. I'll make that the heart. Okay. And this is the spiritual eye right there. There's my person. Okay, it's a little out of proportion, this person. Let me put his legs a little higher. That'll be better. Okay, the chakras are seven in number, although I'll explain it all here. And the first chakra is at the base of the spine. It approximately corresponds to where the anus is in the physical body, just at the level. The second chakra is where the genitals are, where the sexual organs are. The third chakra is at the navel. Okay, we always number them from the bottom like this. Third chakra is at the navel. And the fourth chakra is the heart. The fifth chakra is the throat. Okay, and the sixth chakra is the spiritual eye. And the seventh chakra is the crown chakra here. Yogananda, I'll put that in a minute. These chakras also have, there are many earth, water, fire, air, ether. Ether is used in the old-fashioned sense when people, not the ether that puts you to sleep, but ether is thought to be that physical reality which is more subtle than air, the all-pervasive physical reality. Yogananda called the sixth chakra super ether, which is just something he made up in English. Okay, and this doesn't really have an element because we're beyond creation. What we're dealing with when we're dealing this way is we're dealing with ever more subtle levels of reality. Earth is the most solid. Water is still a fixed reality, but it's more mutable. Fire transforms and breaks up. You know, when you have fire, that which is physical can be released from the rigidity of its form. Air, you can't even see the form of air, even though it's still physical. Ether is the same. Super ether is beyond that. Now, what these chakras represent, this chakra is also known as the spiritual eye, we often call it. Sometimes people call it the Christ Center, and that's not the Jesus Christ Center. Jesus was Jesus the Christ, because Christ means the anointed one. So this being the Christ Center, is what it represents is it's the place of spiritual anointment. So when we, Jesus was the Christ because his consciousness, he lived at this point, and that made him anointed in the spirit. The word Krishna, which is common, of course, in India, is actually the same word. He was also Jadava Krishna. And so he wasn't, he was the Krishna. Yogananda often wrote Krishna like this to try to show that they were the same word, Krishna. But most people don't. But they were both Christ, and that's the point we're talking about. Now, every time... Okay, what we're working with, and this is what is so challenging about spiritual life, is we're working with what our senses tell us is valid and true, and also what is, and it doesn't mean that it isn't there. You know, this world is pretty present. We're all experiencing it. But the question is what we're seeing all there is? Or is there a reality that is just as objectively real, but it's simply not perceivable by the senses, and therefore you have to quantify it and understand it in a different way. Nowadays, the scientific world is moving into that realm of that which cannot be perceived with the senses, but they're proving, you know, all these different ways by how this, what this world really is and how it really works. You know, the science and spirituality are coming together in a very interesting way. Western scientists have gotten to these extremely subtle truths by looking at the material world and then looking at it more and more and more intensely and analyzing it from so many different angles until they're beginning to realize that what we're looking at is not really what it is. From the Eastern side, for thousands of years, yogis in Tibet and India and Nepal and other of these places have been trying to understand what is my own consciousness by looking deeper and deeper inside of myself. And they're coming to the same conclusions, that we are not what we seem. There's a whole other reality going on behind us. Now, even without having to go all the way to string theory or things that I don't even understand at all, I can't touch any of that, we recognize that even though we all share a certain common understanding. You know, we all knew how to find this room. We all essentially agree what this room is like. When I refer to parking in the parking lot and walking by the Chinese herb store, everybody, we've all had that experience together, haven't we? But nonetheless, as we sit here and as you reflect on your life, people still live in very different worlds, don't we? You know, what we perceive and what we like. I'm a person who I like quiet. I'm very sensitive to loud noises. I really don't like dissonant noises. I have a intense, overwhelming aversion to what is called music these days. Just this loud, thumping, cacophonous. I find it extremely unpleasant. I have been, until I recently retired, I was a one-man committee appointed by myself to campaign against unpleasant noise on the planet. And recently I realized I have to quit because nobody's listening to me. They can't hear me. But nonetheless, so I swim at the YMCA, and I was there the other day, and this woman is fixing her hair and her makeup and so on after her workout. And suddenly she's decided it's a good idea to bring into the room her little device, which she turns on to whatever it is that she likes to listen to. Fortunately, I think somebody told her that you really can't do that. But anyway, she did it, and I just said something like, you know, I don't really enjoy listening to that. And she just answered me, I like it, and I'm going to play it. I mean, you know, it was her right to do so. But to her, it was an extremely positive experience. And even the thought that she was imposing on other people who might not want it, just wasn't part of her reality. I mean, so there were so many different places where we're standing right next to each other, but we were just living in different worlds completely. I mean, that's the smallest thing. Just think how many times in your life and in your experience some person thinks this is a good idea and this is what you think is a good idea. Someone wants this and this is what you want, and it just so many different conceptions of what's appropriate, what's positive, what's beautiful, what's real even. And it's amazing, isn't it? Now, if we look back on the biggest picture, the chakras represent for us a very interesting reality. Every time we make any decision in our lives, and that decision may be to speak or to have a feeling or to take an action, whatever it is, we are affirming some concept of reality. Now, we might not stop and think, what concept of reality shall govern what I order for lunch, or however you might want to think about it, but just that's what we're doing. We're deciding two primary questions. We're deciding, where does my happiness come from? And what causes me suffering? What's real in this world? What's enduringly real? We're just making choices based on how we perceive on the biggest level. That woman in the YMCA, her reality was, I want it. The fact that I'm standing right next to her and I didn't was really quite irrelevant to her. So if we think of it in terms of the chakras, now I want to say this about the chakras. There's so many different angles to this subject, which is why I started by recommending you take a longer course than the one I'm giving, because we can pick it up from many different ways, and you can explain certain things this way and certain things that way. It's common to think these are the lower chakras and these are the higher chakras, but I'm going to get to the point where I explain all chakras are good chakras. It just depends on how you use them. Okay, but from this point of view, we're going to talk lower and higher. From the point of view of most gross, and I don't just mean that most appalling, but just gross meaning unsubtle, to most subtle. And what determines gross to subtle in this is the degree to which I as an individual have separated myself from everything else in creation. And when we think of Earth, this is the material world, everything that's material has a fixed form, doesn't it? You know, I can just drop it and it falls, and I pick it up and it's still an eraser, isn't it? I'll use water as the second example. There's water in this cup, and in the cup it looks like the cup, doesn't it? And if I pour it on the rug, suddenly it looks like the rug. But it's still water. It's still water, but its form is a little more... It can move about and adapt more to things. So, and fire and so on, I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but right here, just to get the concept, that woman, her consciousness was absolutely fixed like an eraser. I like the music. And I'm not going to adapt to you at all, period. I'm just going to play my music because I want to and I can. Okay, my reality is, well, I live in a shared universe, and if I play my music in this very small dressing room, all the other people in here get to listen to it. And because of the concept of the heart, where we really are empathizing with other people's feelings also, then I can feel it. If they don't like it, I'm not going to enjoy it as much. If I'm just an eraser, it really doesn't matter what's going on, because I remain what I am no matter what. And now, whether or not there is something happening all the time anyway, I'm talking about our own concept of what's real. And her own concept of what's real was very first chakra oriented. Now, third chakra gives us the power to transmute energy, to transform energy, transform form with energy. So my first impulse when this lady says, she's going to play her music and I really don't want to, is, you know, it wasn't really my first impulse, but it's always an option, is to grab her dratted little thing and, you know, just lock it in my own locker or throw it, you know, against the wall and smash it. Because my earth center says, what about me? But I thought for a moment about what it must be like to be so locked into your own reality that you can't even be that considerate. And I exercised a little willpower and a little compassion. And then I said, okay, and just walked out of the room. So when I made a decision in regard to her decision, I was working with a number of realities. I was also working with my spiritual self, which is, I have my own things too. And if I go around judging the whole world, this is not going to work for me. This is not how Jesus would have responded. How would Jesus respond? And what would Jesus do? He wouldn't have disliked this woman as much as I wanted to. So I reacted from all of that. Now, every time we do anything, and the fascinating thing about the chakras is there is not one second of your life in which this system does not apply, and I'll explain to you in a few moments more why. We are always making decisions, taking actions, having responses that are based on some concept of reality and some concept of what's going to make us happy. And because we are, and this gets a little complicated, so I won't bother to go too deep into it, but because we are identified and defined by what we do, we remember it and it affects us. So it's not like I can just take that lady's device and smash it somewhere and just sort of get away scot-free. You know, a consequence is put in motion. Because now, talking about each of these chakras, as I was a while ago, as a wheel, it's talking about a whirling field of energy. Whenever we put out energy, because we are identified as individuals, even if we live through all our chakras in a gracious way, we're still held by that essential definition. It's a very high level of spirituality before you break that. So it's not relevant to most of us yet, but that's where we're going. Every time I do anything, it registers as a little blip of energy in whatever chakra represents the vibration of consciousness from which I have acted. Okay? So if you think of each of the chakras, they're actually wheels of energy, but if you think of them as little jars that people put coins into, I have my little jar where I put all my coins because I don't like to carry them around in my purse, and you know, gradually it fills up, doesn't it? The more coins you put in, the more it fills up. So whatever actions you take and how often you repeat them and how big the denomination of the coin is, you know, I kind of went through the lady in the dressing room and it did affect me and I've continued to talk about it, but it wasn't like a massive experience for me, but it was worth at least 50 cents. Was more than a penny. And so each time we do something that represents any one of the qualities of these chakras, energy is deposited. And it stays there. And so when people, for example, read your chakras, what they're reading, either because they can feel it, or because they can see it, or because they can sense it, there's many ways to move into the more subtle dimensions, they're feeling the quantity, the power, and the character of the energy that you have deposited by your own actions in your own chakras. And if, for example, you have been very mean-spirited, well, there's just lots of different kinds of examples. If you've been very, very selfish and you just have a huge amount of energy just locked up in what about me, if you have a lot of fire energy and that fire energy is used to transform yourself, it has a certain kind of energy. If it's fire energy that you're using always to attack the people around you and trying to get them to transform, that has a certain kind of energy. If your heart energy is very selflessly loving, that has a certain vibration to it. If your heart energy is very, I want, I need, why aren't you taking care of me? That has a certain vibration. And the thing about this system is, there's no way to cheat it. No matter what you say, no matter how you've deceived yourself even, you're just vibrating according to whatever you actually really think is real. Now, what's so interesting about this is all of this is what brings us into this world and makes our bodies as a baby. And this is what goes away with us when this physical body dies. This is essentially what reincarnates, what takes on another body. And pardon me?
Are you talking about the heart chakra?
No, the whole chakra system. This energy body is in the astral world. It's vibrating in a certain way. It's in the astral world. The physical world is a world. It's very hot in here, isn't it? Yeah, wow. I don't know how to do anything about that. No, that's all right. I was thinking more of you all than of me. Yeah, we need an air conditioning. If anybody wants to volunteer and go tell somebody we're boiling back here, but otherwise, we'll. So maybe when somebody comes by, I'll get their attention. Let's see now. Oh yes, the physical world, this physical universe, is a realm of very mixed levels of consciousness, isn't it? You have very saintly people living on this planet, and at the present time, you also have some really terrifyingly not saintly people on the planet. And we're all sharing the same planet together. You could be sitting waiting for a bus next to someone who has a very, very terrible consciousness. You could just be right next to each other in this world. In the astral world, which is what people call heaven or hell, which is the world where you go to between your physical births, it's all vibration. So vibrations here, because we're encased in physical bodies, we can be next to each other and the physical body dulls those vibrations. But you will still feel that you don't, ooh, I have an aversion to that person. You know, you won't know why. Or you'll feel very drawn to someone and you may not know why. It's because your vibrations match or repel one way or another. Some people have a huge aura. When somebody told me they met Bill Clinton once, and they were just overwhelmed by the sheer force of his energy. You know, he was that kind of a man, is that kind of a man, maybe less so. But his energy was just so powerful that his vibration just went out way like that. When I met Swami Kriyananda, that's what I felt, just instantly, literally. His vibration was, he had no boundaries. It went out as, you know, past the edges of the room, and it was all very, very refined. I mean, I had never seriously thought about any of that, but then I was suddenly there, and thank you, God, I recognized it, and I realized it was the vibration I was looking for. But when we go into the astral world, we go into a world that matches our vibration. And if we're a good person, we go into something that would look more like heaven, and if we're evil, we go into something that looks more like hell. And that's where those ideas come from. It's not up or down, anything like that. It's just the actual vibration of our consciousness. So we're in the astral world, and for most people, it's kind of a rest. It's a little like going to Hawaii. You know, I know people actually live in Hawaii, but most people just vacation in Hawaii. You just hang out there, and it's so nice and just easy to be there. And we learn, we reflect. We can grow in the astral world. We can grow. We have astral karma too. We just kind of sort things out. It's a very different world. And if you're dark, if you're very materialistic, if you smoke, if you take drugs, if you're really into sex, if you're way into food and all the things that you need a physical body to do, and if your consciousness is so trapped in the lower chakras that the only vibrations you can actually perceive have to be gross vibrations, you don't even wake up in the astral world. You just die and you kind of go in what Yogananda described as kind of a gray dream, is what he said. And you rest, because even though you're not conscious when you're sleeping, you're still resting. So you rest. You rest from the effort of the incarnation. And you don't wake up again until you have a physical body, because that's the only vibration you recognize. And what brings us back into a physical body is we use up our astral karma, we use up our desire and ability to learn and grow on that subtle vibration, and unlearned lessons draw us back into this world. Unresolved issues with other people, unresolved issues within ourselves, desires that weren't fulfilled, that need to be fulfilled, regrets that we want to make better. And so we're in the astral world, and what happens is gradually these little vortices of energy make us restless. I mean, that's what happens all the time anyway, isn't it? Oh, I'm going to spend the whole evening at home. I'm going to meditate and then do some yoga and write a few letters and, you know, just all these different things. Then we get kind of restless, and maybe instead I'll go out and get a pizza. Hey, maybe I'll go to the movie. I mean, you've had it happen, haven't you? That you're going one direction and then something pulls you in another. Well, that's the whirling energy in the chakras, which is always pulling. You know, it's emanating and it's pulling. It's always creating movement. And depending on what system we've built up, depends on which way we're drawn. So we get drawn down into, there's the way Yogananda describes it, when the sperm and ovum come together, he says, there's a flash of light in the astral world that has a certain vibration which represents the sum total of the chakras of that man and that woman and all of the karmic potential that is inherent in that vibration. And as Yogananda puts it, all those souls in the astral world that are ready to incarnate, they'll be drawn toward that vibration. And he said, and sometimes, he put it this way, he says, they rush toward it, but not every one of them can get in. He said, sometimes more than one will come in, and that's where you have twins or triplets or something like that. But there's also the implication of that is that you have sort of many different choices. I can't really answer any of that. I just find it extremely interesting. And here's my favorite part of this. He said, sometimes if a soul wants to be born in a certain place, they will project erotic thoughts into the room to try to get their parents together so that they can be conceived. I've heard more than one person tell me, I don't know why we conceived that child. Well, maybe you conceived that child because that child wanted to be born. What was I thinking? But it happens. I always find it amusing when children blame their parents for their life circumstances. Honey, it was a flash of light in the astral world. It wasn't my fault. You didn't have to come. I'll tell you another story that I just love. A woman friend of mine, when she first heard me say that about the astral world and about children rushing to get in, and obviously not everyone can make it, her little boy, her son wasn't nearly grown when she was telling this, but her son was 5 once, she said. She always remembered. And he got really mad at her, as children do. And he declared with his whole heart, I hate you, Mommy. You're the worst mommy in the world. And then he stomped out of the room. And then he decided that really wasn't enough. And he came back to his mother and he said, you weren't even my first choice. And she was very interested. Well, honey, who was your first choice? I mean, she didn't know anything about any of these teachings. It was the clear blue sky to her. Who was your first choice? And he said, a lady in the Philippines, but she was taken. And then when she heard me say all this, she said her son, who was a very intelligent, strong fellow, but she said he had a funny characteristic. He would move first really strong, and then he would always stop for a second and then reconsider. She could just see him in the astral world heading for that lady in the Philippines and then stopping for just a second. And while he paused, somebody else got in. And he got stuck with her. But there are many. What we're also saying, what Yogananda's implying, is we have many different karmas, because now what these circles of energy in the chakras represent, this is unresolved energy. Another way of saying it is, this is something we haven't yet learned that we're going to have to learn. That lady in the YMCA today. Because eventually all of these energies have to resolve into an understanding that we are a Christ, that we are one with the infinite. The greatest misunderstanding of Christianity is they don't understand that that which Jesus did, we shall do in greater things. Be therefore perfect, even as our Father in heaven is perfect. That which I do, ye shall do. Because Jesus understood it, but the churches don't understand it. So they don't tell you that what Jesus was Jesus was the absolute resolution of all of these conflicting vortices of energy, and all of his energies just flowed completely freely through all of these chakras, but it all expressed through the spiritual eye. Because from the point of view of the spiritual eye, I am one with all of creation. So this is what, I'll give you a moment to just depart because it's distracting to me. So if you're going to leave, go ahead. Thank you. So each of these whirling energies within the chakras, sooner or later, has to be resolved and understood and moved up to a higher level. That lady in the YMCA had to understand that herself, I am part of a greater reality. I cannot separate my actions out and imagine that I can just do what I want without it affecting others. And even more profoundly, when I act contrary to the highest truth, which is that I am one with the greater reality, I am the one who suffers the most. And that, quite simply, is what karma is. Karma is what you don't know about your relationship to the greatest reality, and what you don't know about where your own suffering comes from because of our inability to embrace that greater reality. And it's, but now you can say it like that, but it's very, very complicated to unravel. So, for example, and I mean, she's one, but let's just say, well, I knew a man who had a very severely disabled child, and the child, it was a lifelong obligation. This man was never, and the child was so severely disabled, there was no satisfaction in an ordinary sense of being a parent. It was just a really big responsibility that absolutely defined his life and would for the rest of his life. And he asked me, you know, why would something like this happen to me? And, you know, I don't know. So, I mean, I don't have the capacity to look into him and say, but I thought, let's think about it. Here's an example. A man fathers 3 or 4 or 5 children and then grows bored and has a pretty secretary and just sails off, you know, and just leaves the mother. Or can work in reverse. The mother just gets worn out with taking care of all these children and just wants to be free and finds a boyfriend and goes sailing off and leaves the father for the rest of his life to have to take care of that responsibility, and you've just walked away from it. Do we think that we can just walk away from it? Maybe it all worked out fine, apparently. But nonetheless, there was an action taken at a certain point that it wasn't like God wants to punish you, but a decision was made that did not take into account higher realities, that affirmed limited realities. This is me, this is what I want. I'm going to use my energy to get what I want. I'm not going to use my energy to think in the freest and most selfless way. And so it's an unlearned lesson. Now, don't misunderstand me. Maybe he didn't have to stay married to her for the rest of his life, or she didn't have to stay married to him. It's not so clear-cut that you have to behave in certain ways. But what reality are we affirming? That's what really counts. What are we really doing inside ourselves? So I'm looking at him and I'm saying, let's imagine. And he could relate enough to the idea. Let's imagine that you just completely bailed on all your parenting responsibilities. So what do you think would be a balancing energy for that? Well, you get parenting responsibilities in spades, don't you? And you just, it's payback time. Now you have to just balance it out. And you have to learn the lesson of responsibility and selflessness. Because what we always come to in the end, and this is what is the promise of the spiritual path, is that when we live in right relationship to the highest reality, we also receive that happiness and fulfillment that we're looking for. It's not, we imagine that it's a punishment system, but it isn't actually. Even, you know, that even the thought that I have to have this in order to be happy is a certain level of reality. But we have to work through these things realistically according to our actual level of consciousness. We can't just impose on ourselves, you know, that, because you can't cheat the system. You can be looking really good, but if inside you're seething and you're not at peace, that's what really registers. Yeah. So that's why I said there's no way to cheat this. So sometimes you make a conscious decision, you know. I'm going to lose more by holding to the form, even though the form is what I'm supposed to hold to, than I will lose by breaking that form and going according to what is more actual and real for me. So from incarnation to incarnation, the vibrations of what we actually believe between I am a separate reality and I get whatever I want and nothing, I'm unconnected to everything, to I am one with the infinite. So we die, but this pattern stays here and we get born right into wherever we need to be in order to start learning it all over again. So it isn't just a question of retribution, which is very grim, especially if you were born into very difficult circumstances. It can be very, very freaky to think, you know, it gets to be more subtle. It's what don't I know? What do I not understand that this circumstance is going to inspire me to learn? So it isn't always just a straight across tit for tat. You did this and so you get it. Sometimes it is. But what it is, what is this going to give me the opportunity to learn that I didn't know? Because when you learn the lesson, then what happens is the energy is freed. And generally speaking, it rises up the spine and you have a higher kind of energy. Think of the power of forgiveness, for example, and how it's been like an anchor just pulling you down all the time. And when you finally let it go, you literally feel this great expansiveness, because literally energy that's been whirling on a grosser level has been freed, and now it's available for you on a higher level. Okay, I'm going to stop and see if you have any questions. Yes. And what will happen to her is, people will be very inconsiderate of her, and she'll be so annoyed. Why don't they take me into account? You know, just as I felt, why aren't you not taking me into account? I transform that energy and just let it go. But what will happen to her is she will be not taken into account over and over again till it occurs to her that this is no fun. And then the next time someone says, I don't want to listen to your music, she'll say, oh, I'm sorry, let me turn it off. Because she'll have figured out that it's... And so that's why it is often you offer, you give it, and it comes back to you because, you know, how does it feel? How does it feel? That's one of the ways we learn. We learn because it's given to us. Oh, look, now I'm stuck with 5 children and I have to raise them by myself because my spouse ran out on me. This is really not much fun. You know, this is really tough. And so the next time one feels a little tempted to do it yourself, you remember you have more empathy. And it may still be a struggle because, you know, you may have individual things you want, but you have fire energy that you can use to transform that. And then the satisfaction of having mastered those impulses and living in right relationship to higher reality, you actually discover is much more gratifying than just running around getting what I want all the time. I mean, even in this world, you see people all the time. Some live more altruistically, very happily. Others are always thinking about themselves. And generally speaking, altruistic people, if they're genuinely altruistic for genuine motive, are generally much happier than people who are just self-centered. That's just the way it is. I mean, an amazing number of teenagers and others, when they're just given something to do, really, you know, something real to do, a lot of their difficulties just go away. A lot of their problem is they don't have anything real to do. I mean, just in high school, people ought to be out doing really important, challenging things all the time. I mean, a lot of the reason why teenagers are so discontented is because they're just bored, and there's no idealism. There's nothing for them to raise their energy to, and they're not mature enough to think it out. Yes, George. There are many different ways that people interpret life. And what I'm presenting to you is a very, very ancient idea. And I'll write just this word up here. And this is not just mine. It's Sanatan Dharma, it's called. It's a Sanskrit name. And that actually means the eternal truth. And all the teachings, to my experience, and I'm no expert on anything except what I've given my life to, all the other systems fit somewhere into Sanatan Dharma, but they're just a piece of the picture. And I make no effort to convert people, but a teaching like, you know, you just do what you're supposed to do here and then you get to go to paradise forever, to my mind, there's just too many holes in it. I just can't quite make that one work. And a lot of times I don't feel inspired by people who are just doing their duty here. And I have a hard time thinking that merely because you stick it out, that's the right thing to do, instead of being authentic and, you know, just holding the form. There's just too many holes in the system for me. What I found when I start talking like this, with karma, reincarnation, and the chakras, which are through the three main elements, I can sort of make this work. I can't find the holes in this system. And now I've spent a lot of years working with it, and I didn't just take it the first time I heard it. I just have been, I try to analyze my own life, and I try to understand life around me as if these realities were true. And all I can say is that this really works, especially the way Kriyananda has expressed it in many different places. It just works. It's just like everything I come up against, I can make it work. How come the bad guy just dies peacefully in his bed and the good person doesn't? Well, this is a long story. You know, why shouldn't I just chase down the murderer and smash his head in? Well, this is a long story. Why is it that I mean so well in my heart, but I still do such stupid things? Well, it's a long story. You know, I can see it. It works for me. Were you going to ask the same question? What were you going to say? No.
Uh-huh. I'm interpreting what you're saying is that
Sanatan Dharma.
You're saying we never escape.
No, you escape finally, but you don't escape until you yourself have resolved every aspect of your own inclination, and you simply always choose the highest level of reality, that all of these inclinations are resolved.
Yeah, but so when, if somebody happens to do that, a saint or something.
Yeah, that's what makes you a saint or a Christ, yes.
So then you go and you don't have to.
I incarnate, have reincarnated this time, because I don't really have it sorted out yet. Given a choice, I understand now, I have a certain understanding of what I'm trying to do, but I've got a lot of whirling vortices which cause me to keep moving in the wrong direction. So my whole life has been devoted to constantly working to try to gain the mastery, to constantly choose where my own happiness really comes from.
Yes.
Because nothing would pull me back. You would only come back. Jesus said, you all were born with sin, I was born without sin. What that meant is he had no karma. He came back, he had no unlearned lessons. See, Christianity actually fits this perfectly. It's just that certain key points, like reincarnation, in 500 AD, reincarnation was taken out of the Bible. It was part of the teachings of Jesus until the church decided it wasn't going to be. And if there's still a few little things left in the Bible, when Jesus says, who do you think I am? And they start naming prophets from the past. Why would they name prophets from the past? Because reincarnation was part of their system. And then they talked about that Elijah has to come first. And Jesus says, but Elijah has come already, and you just didn't know it. Well, who was he? He was John the Baptist. That's what Jesus just says straight out. What could you possibly be talking about? And I mean, there's documents on that. But the point is, you can come back deliberately only to help others. That's what Jesus meant when he said he was born without sin. He had nothing. There was nothing. He was a Christ. And they come back, Buddha, Yogananda, others. I'm going to give someone else a chance to ask a question. Listen. Yeah, we've all been back many times. I know sometimes someone will tell you as if that was news, but we've all been back more times than you ever want to know. It's a very long, slow process. Yes, we've all been back here a long time. Even by the time you're curious about this, you've been coming back for a while.
When you said it like you know why you are here, we all in this planet, we are not more or less in the same level of learning.
On this planet, that's right. Yeah. Yes, this planet has many different levels at the same time. So people are learning different lessons on the same planet.
But right. We are all here for to learn something.
You wouldn't be here if you didn't have karma in your chakras that compelled you back. Unless you were a Christ, and if you were, you wouldn't be sitting here.
<That's right.
laughs> you might be, but not likely. Well, or you'd be standing here. You'd be doing something different, you know.
Right.
But otherwise, you can just count on it. Yes.
I don't,
First of all, not being one, I don't know. Yogananda himself said that he was in his line of masters. Swami Kriyananda was a highly evolved soul. He had Christ consciousness, I believe, but I don't know. There's something called, there's an avatar, which is one who is completely free before they're born. There's a Jivanmukta, there's a Siddha. It all has very subtle levels. Certainly, Swami, who I knew, he was free in every way that I could measure. But he himself said that he had attained the freedom in the life he just finished. But there's very subtle points about that that are explained in various places, subtle degrees of freedom. You can see a name. Not all of them are known. You know, generally speaking, a Christ has a great power that is discernible by all. There's some, you know, hidden Christ whose service to the world is entirely vibrational. Babaji is described in Yogananda's autobiography as an ever-living Christ in the Himalayas, even now, living in his body. I'm sure there are many others, thank God. But not that many. It's not like every fifth person you meet has that level of consciousness. Some people may think they do, and I'm not going to argue with them. It wouldn't be appropriate. But when you meet someone whose life is really different, you know. And it's observable. I'd lived very closely with Swami Kriyananda for 40 years, and it's observable day after day after day. Just it's not that their lives don't have challenges, but the way they meet those challenges is so different, just completely different. I just can't imagine anyone being more master of himself and in right relationship to the whole planet than I saw in him. But I don't know where he fits on the spectrum. I think he...
Very,
because he wasn't conflicted, and he wasn't compelled. See, what happens to all the rest of us, speaking for myself, why did I say that? Why did I get so mad? Why did I get so agitated about that? Why am I lying awake worrying about this? Because somewhere I'm not master of my energy, and I don't fully believe that there is only one reality, and that reality is God, and I will just surrender to that, and why would I have any anxiety? Why would I strike out? Why would I feel frightened? Why do I feel I need to protect myself? Because I have karma in my chakras that I think in this circumstance I need to. This lady in the YMCA thought she had the right to play her music, and she struck out at me because I was trying to take it away from her. I'm not going to do that. But it's not so different when somebody does something I don't like and I try to push back against them instead of being able to calmly assess. And it doesn't mean you're always nice, but it's quite different to calmly assess it and say the appropriate response is no. That's quite different than just saying no without having the freedom to make the choice. What I saw in Swami Kriyananda, every choice he made was free.
So your work is in each chakra is what you're supposed to be working on.
Exactly.
But how to do that?
Aha, now see.
Okay. Because it's not easy. It's not easy.
I have
here's what's really quite simply happening. Energy meets energy, and whichever is the stronger energy dominates the weaker. She has stronger energy to pull you down than you have energy to lift yourself up. So the answer to that is, well, one is, but you have a shared living parent. But the other thing is you have to develop your own magnetism in independent ways. Well, or that your capacity to hold your own that your energy becomes strong enough not to be eaten up by hers. And how you do this, Louisa, is the entire spiritual path. You know, meditation, right living, right diet, right attitude, exercise, fresh air,
yeah.
Music, everything.
So you don't let that bother you.
Well, so that you're always nurturing upward moving energy, right company, just everything that nurtures upward moving energy. Every single thing that you do, every decision you make and everything that nurtures it. So anything that takes your energy away, down from or away from where you know it want to be is not your friend. And anything that increases your energy toward where you want it to be is your friend. And when you deeply really begin to get this, then it just becomes the way you live. I mean, there I am in the why. You know, she was being exceedingly rude to me. I think she was in the wrong. I mean, maybe she was even breaking the rules. But I had to stand there for just a minute and think, do I even really want to go here? And I said, no, I don't think so. And I just very tearfully said, okay. And I really meant it. Now, it doesn't change the fact that I think she was in the wrong, but I just made a choice. Because if I had gotten sucked into her, it would have just taken me someplace I didn't want to go.
I just said nothing and walked out.
Yeah, well, I decided I needed to actually actively put out energy to her. Because I also looked at her and thought, you poor soul. Well, it was so. I mean, there was 100 solutions, you know, but what I finally decided was, see, this is all part of, am I actually the one woman policewoman of the noise level of the entire planet, which I have been for a long time, but I have not felt that it's serving my development of Christ consciousness, so I've given it up.
You might have done something down the road. Maybe she's going to take your words in and go, you know what? Maybe I was wrong.
Maybe yes, maybe no. I have to also decide: is it my responsibility to teach her or to love her? You know? And these are very personal decisions based on, because sometimes, okay, you're talking about being an oppressed minority here, and sometimes the karmic lesson is, you leave me alone. It's necessary to stand up strong. And sometimes the karmic lesson is, what difference does it make to me? You don't know. It depends on what the circle is. That's why I said it's not about how you behave. It's about what's really moving you. If, for example, the karmic lesson is, really, I'm as good as you, because if I relate properly to the greater reality, that includes me. I don't have to be your doormat. There's nothing spiritual about my being your doormat. You know, that's just my actual wrong understanding that I think I'm supposed to be the doormat of the planet. So there could be, it could be that your job is to just tell them to get out of your life or leave me alone, or don't you dare speak to me like that. But the difference between flashing out and not being master of your energy is quite different than making a decision that says, well, the difference is their energy is running you,
right,
or your energy is running you.
And then what happens is I know how much physical damage I'm capable of, and I have to block that. I'm still a mess.
Yeah, it's true, but now we have to say something else which is not going to be happy for you to hear. This wouldn't be happening to you if it wasn't in your best interests.
Right. Well, I'm not arguing with that.
Yeah.
But I would rather...
Then I think you need to work on strengthening your inner magnetism and worry less about this relationship. This relationship is difficult for you because your inner magnetism isn't strong enough. So that's where... Well, regardless, if you may be compelled because of the family situation, but you need to be working on your inner magnetism, whatever that looks like to you. You know, whether, as I say, that's meditation, exercise, diet, painting, dance, music, travel, you know, taking care of dogs, whatever it might be, but whatever it is that gives you power, because you're not going to win this way.
No,
you have to go train.
It's absolutely senseless.
Yeah, you have to go up here and train.
It's absolutely senseless. And when I...
Yeah, okay, but, yeah, I understand. I know, right, because you need to train your magnetism. And, you know, that's what it always comes down to. It's not, they're not wrong. They're just bigger. I mean, they may be wrong also, but the big problem is they're bigger than you, but that becomes your problem. Why am I not as big as them? So then what am I doing in my life that's taking my energy? And a lot of times you just can't fight, this karma's too big. I can't fight this battle. Swami Kriyananda said that to me once. I was in a karma like this. He said, and I had the opportunity to just get away from it. But I was a little concerned, you know. I said, oh, don't worry, it'll come back. But what you need to do is, he said, put it on the shelf. He said, and just go over here and get strong. And you don't have to even look for it because it'll come back. But if you're constantly going to lose, what's the point? Go over here and get strong. Just leave it.
Right.
It'll come back. If not in this life, in another, you can depend on it, because as long as it's whirling in there, it's going to come to you. You can't cheat the system.
So it is all karma.
Everything is karma.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely everything. Everything. Karma is these unresolved vortices of energy in the chakras. that's karma. So therefore, everything is karma because nothing happens except as a result of these vortices of energy in the chakras. Yes. Well, I'm going to recommend to you that you weren't here when I said this. Go onto this YouTube channel, and there's a 4-part course. But I'll tell you, I'll just give you this very quick summary of it. Earth, water, fire, air, and ether, super ether. This is the way. Earth energy, the first chakra is about security, about rigidity. Okay, the first chakra is about your security. And so the question is, where does my security come from? Does it come from money? Does it come from things? Does it come from everybody doing what I want them to do? Or does my security come from my understanding that I am one with the infinite spirit and I am always protected in God's light? Because, of course, everybody has to feel secure. It's not like you don't need your first chakra, but where is that security coming from?
You don't get it from material.
Yeah, is the energy going, circulating, so to speak, through that chakra, then all my energy comes up and my security comes from my relationship with a higher reality? Or does my security come from, you need to do this, you need to do that, I have to have this, I have to have that? People talk about the energy being blocked, and it is because it doesn't flow to here, but it also leaks. It's leaking out. Your chakra is full of holes. The water chakra is flexibility, intuition. I mean, it's related to sexuality, but it's really flexibility, intuition, to be able to be creative, to just always see things in a new way. Sexuality, making babies, is the ultimate sort of physical creativity. But what we're really talking about is being able to keep my own identity no matter what reality I'm in. Now, if you're secure in yourself, you can share other people's realities. It's when you're very insecure that you're very threatened by anybody else's realities. You know, very rigid religious teachings are very earth chakra oriented. And they just can't handle any possibility. But if you're secure, you can be very fluid. Okay, so if you have a rigidity to yourself, maybe you need to ask where your security is coming from. The fire chakra is your willpower and your ability to choose a goal and direct your energy toward it. And so if you're secure in yourself, if you're flexible in your thinking, then you can take the power of fire, and really make something happen.
Problem is, everybody needs money to work, to live, and cover your...
Right. Well, but it's not about fulfilling your dreams. It's being able to master your own energy. I'm just, in this case, I'm giving it just a little bit of a picture. So you can ask yourself, I have all these intuitive ideas. I'm very flexible in all these ways, but I don't have enough fire. You know, I don't have enough fire to make something happen. So you can see that this is the chakra that needs work. The air chakra is when you begin to empathize and have compassion and be able to really think about the realities of others. And that's what air is. It's sort of everywhere. So you might have lots of fire, but you're always using it to gallop over other people. Or you may have so much air that you're always empathizing, but you don't have enough earth to keep you grounded. And you're falling in love with somebody different every other day. You know, there's just no solidity to what you're doing. Ether is when it's communication. It's really being able to put your energy out into the world in a very calm and centered way. Now, that was very, very quick. But you can sort of see how all of them need to work together in order for it to work. And then we transfer all, everything becomes combined here. Meditation that takes place at the spiritual eye tends to harmonize all of the chakras because it pulls all the energy into a harmonious, governed by our relationship to a greater reality. You had a question. Work on that. Okay. I'm going to send you to here. And also, all of spiritual practice, yoga postures, meditation especially, affirmations, right attitudes, all of it, because see, every time you do something that affirms a better reality, you're energizing that aspect of yourself. This is where the Ten Commandments comes from, even. It's that you know, if I behave according to this way, if I genuinely behave according to this, then I'm building magnetism in the direction that I want to go. What understanding the chakras does is there's specific exercises, specific affirmations. There's a book. I have to just send you to websites because I'm not really quite sure where things can be found. But people will train you. We will train you. You know, and in an hour and a half, I can't do it. You know, just really how to look at yourself and then feel like there's certain affirmations that are part of that other course that I gave that, like, if you see that what I really need is fire, then you start just cultivating that attitude of fire and you start making decisions on the basis of fire. If you see what I need is greater flexibility, you start making decisions on the basis of that, or greater security based on the right realities.
Is part of it also not just to feel better in this way?
Yes. Everything that you do, absolutely everything you do.
So you do more of the things that build your fire, or more of the things
exactly.
That build your water.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly. And that's why, especially these five, you can look at your life and see where your weakness is. Based on, I mean, you can look at it more conscientiously than I just did, but you can sort of get the picture, what part of you really needs to be fixed here. For me and the lady in the YMCA, I don't have any trouble telling people what I think and what I think they ought to do. Like, this is not a learning, this is not a growth area for me. The growth area for me is not to let that take me over. You know, so I started and then I saw that it wasn't what I was supposed to do. But there was a time when I was 18 years old and I spent the summer in New York City and I needed a lot more fire. Great place to get it because people are so rude. You can just be really outspoken and, to my mind, just unreasonably unkind, and nobody even notices. So I got to practice a lot until I began to enjoy it. And then I decided, I don't think this is really who I want to be. But it was remedial. I really had to do it. Security is always an issue. Am I secure using myself as an example? Am I secure because people like me? Because they think I'm smart? Because they take me into account? Because they think about me first? Or am I secure because I just am? You know? But a lot of my fire comes from my earth not being in the right place. Because I'm always trying to make myself, have been, I'll use it more in the past tense, make myself secure by making them behave. I want my world to look like this and you're out of line and I'll use my fire to make you. Yeah.
Growing up, and yeah. That's how you teach your kids.
And you get into, and you're born into a family where it all gets to play itself out, doesn't
and
that's
it? That's where we have to cut that off.
Yeah. Or I've got, you know, you've got so much fire that I can't empathize. You know, I'm too busy with myself. I need to be, or I'm so busy with everyone else that I'm always with everybody else, and I have no self. It goes all different ways, depending on what you've been depositing and what the circles are.
Regarding to karma, when you told me the story about that boy that said in my first...
Well, also, you also have to understand, this was a fun thing that Ananda... See, all our children in our community we've raised, we're into our third generation now, all these kids are caught with this philosophy. You know, we don't indoctrinate them, but it's all around them and they hear it. So when they get to be teenagers and they begin to rebel against their parents, the parents can always say, not my fault, you chose me. So there was this one man who was just a wonderful sort of an uncle. Yeah, he was a wonderful uncle to all the kids. And so they went to him and said, you know, I would never have chosen them, you know, that kind of energy that teens have. And he then goes to Swami Kriyananda and says, what am I supposed to say? He said, sometimes I don't know why they chose those parents either. I wouldn't have chose those parents, you know. And Swami's answer was, it's not like you choose absolutely every little detail. Even just, for example, you might really want this woman to be your mother. Maybe this is your mother right here. And your mother is involved with your father. And your father's required for you to come to this mother, but you may not overlap very much with your father. You may just be involved with your mother. Or your mother may be very involved with her oldest son, but maybe you're really just involved over here. Or maybe you're just involved with the oldest son and you're not involved with the mother. Because it's just, you know, but that doesn't mean that it's not correct. It just means that you don't have to torture every detail. Some of it is just more part of your story than other parts. And it becomes tiresome to try to make every little detail. You just use your common sense. Or you just say, well, this is really the main event that I'm working on. You know. Swami said it can be just a few characteristics that will just unite you. Just a few things that just make that incarnation work. And sometimes you choose a family where you don't really have that much in common because you don't want to have that much to do with that family. You're just going to, as Swami put it to me, get a body and then get on with your life. And you specifically don't want a family where there's a lot of karma. You know, you don't want to be really involved. You just choose someone where there's just, you know, there's enough there for you to get a body and then you can get off and go on your life. And it's not necessarily a weakness on your part. It was just a choice. This is what I wanted this time. Maybe you just were buried by your family for so many incarnations. You just said, no more of that. Yeah. Well, great souls, we've gone quite a while. I'm more than happy to keep answering questions, but I want to signal the official end so you may depart. This was recorded. Recordings don't appear on YouTube because they have to be because there has to be a tube. But the magazine that you have, the Ananda magazine, has a website, Ananda Palo Alto, and this recording will appear on that website before too long, if you want. And there's lots of, as I said on the YouTube channel, the same subject as I must have talked at least 30 times. It must be 30. Okay. But the four part course is the best one. Okay. Thank you. YouTube. Yeah, just Google my name. Thank you. Certainly, my pleasure. Okay.